Hello and again, welcome to the Labyrinth Library Podcast. How are you doing this week? I hope you are well. I'm doing well. The weather's great. It's very nice. My birthday is on the weekend. It's on Sunday. Unfortunately, my birthday's on Sunday. And I'm sure you all know what's happening on Saturday. Saturday, according to a small group of churchgoers, is apparently the day that Jesus is coming back and all the good Christians are being raptured away. And after that, there's going to be hell on earth for a little while, and I think the whole works get blown up somewhere in October. Point is, Jesus is totally stealing my weekend. You know, this is going to be my weekend. I was going to go out and do crazy things and have my birthday, and no, Jesus is coming back and he's just ruining the whole thing. So, now there are upsides to this. Number one, I think I am probably not on, you know, the rapture list. You know, I love my friends very much, but honestly, guys, neither are you. I believe that if, by some bizarre coincidence, the rapture actually does happen, there'll probably be only something like 15 people on the entire planet who get taken up, and no one will really notice. So, of course, I think the rapture is not happening on Saturday, and I think that's a ridiculous idea. If you truly believe the rapture is happening on Saturday, though, I've put up a bet on my own Facebook page. I will put up 100,000 yen against your $1,000 that the rapture does not happen. So, you know, put your money where your mouth is. There we go. For the rest of us, we will be raiding empty homes come Saturday evening after 6 o'clock. All right. So that is the big event for this weekend. This week is going pretty well. My students are all analyzing poetry, which is good fun. One of my classes, one of the boys found this 15th century poem. It's a little challenging to read. It's in Old English. It's been kind of, you know, shined up a bit for more modern readers. But the title of the poem is, I Have a Gentle Cock. And it's about a rooster. It's a rooster, probably. And he just found it the funniest thing in the world. So he's gonna go for it. He's going to try to analyze that, and I can't wait for it. But anyway, this week we have kind of a long review. I took a look at it. It's like 3.5 pages, which is long for me. And I gave you a hint last week that this is the kind of book that you read, you've most likely read in high school, and it is, of course, double plus good. I got some correct responses, which made me double plus happy. And the first one was Marissa in the U.S. Congratulations, you receive a free wall screen and you will be watched for the rest of your life. Paul also got it right, Paul from Spain, so good job, Paul. But yeah, if you are an American, especially, and you have been through high school, then you have read this book. And it's the kind of class that of books that's really actually hard to review because everybody's read it, but you know, I'll certainly do my best on it. I think I've come up with some interesting angles anyway. But I thought about this, I did this book for the same reason I did To Kill a Mockingbird, I did during Banned Books Week, and really two reasons. Number one, it's one of the top banned books on the American Library Association, and number two, of course, is that it's really good. Now, anytime I read a book, here's a little bit of process for you if you're one of those process people. Every time I read a book, there's always a little part of me just thinking about what I'm going to say about the book once I finally decide to write it. You know, sometimes I'll start composing in my mind, come up with the pithy words and phrases that have made me into the international book reviewing superstar that I am. This time, though, I honestly could hardly concentrate for the cacophony in my head. There was just so much going on in this novel that doing any sort of justice to it would probably require writing a book that was longer than the book that it was analyzing. As much as I love you guys, I'm not going to write a whole book about this. You know, probably because I reckon better minds than mine already have. And I'm not going to bother to research, but you can if you like. Regardless, it's hard to choose exactly where to go on this one. I mean, there's so many political and sociological, psychological, and philosophical threads to pick up here that no matter what I write about, I'm pretty sure I'll get responses about how I didn't mention the solipsistic nature of Ingsoc and his relationship to the philosophy behind modern cable news network reporting strategies. Don't worry, guys, I did get that one. I suppose two big things came to mind while I was reading it at this time, and the first of them was inspired by the previous book I read, which was To Kill a Mockingbird. In that book, Atticus Finch talks a lot about bravery. To teach his son about what it truly means to be brave, he gets him to take part in an old woman's struggle to free herself of a morphine addiction before she dies. It's an excruciating process that, of course, is more likely to fail than to succeed. But she does it anyway. And Atticus says to his son about bravery, "It's when you're licked, before you begin, but you begin anyway, and you see it through no matter what. You rarely win, but sometimes you do." So the question in my mind as I was reading 1984 was this. Is Winston Smith brave? That's a hard question to answer. By Atticus's definition, you could say that he is. He's a member of the outer party that rules the superstate of Oceana. Winston Smith is part of this greater machine. He works in the records department of the Ministry of Truth, diligently altering and rectifying the data of the past to bring it into alignment with what the party wants to be true. His is a world where there's no such thing as objective truth. The truth is whatever the party says it is. Now, a good member of the party will sublimate his will to that of the party. What Big Brother wants, she wants. She has no love but love for the party, and no dreams but to do what the party wants of her. A good party member doesn't have plans or hopes or dreams. He doesn't ask questions or idly wonder if things could be different from what they are. A good party member doesn't think. He is born, he lives, consumes, and dies. Winston, however, cannot be a good party member. He wonders why the world is the way it is and begins down a road to assert his own identity as a human being. He knows full well that he will fail, that in the end he and the woman he loves will be delivered into the hands of the Thought Police, and he's appropriately terrified. But he goes through with it anyway. He keeps a diary of his thoughts, and he actively tries to join an underground movement that's determined to overthrow the party and Big Brother. He declares himself willing to undertake acts of heinous treason, all in the name of resistance against the party. And in the end, of course, he fails, just like he knew he would. So, does this make Winston, a man who is so far in character from Atticus Finch, a brave person? Well, yes and no. He does meet Atticus's definition of bravery, then, persisting in what you believe to be right, even in the knowledge you'll probably fail. Winston puts his own life on the line multiple times, committing thought crime of the highest order. But is he doing this for some higher ideal, or is he doing it for more selfish reasons? Now, flashbacks to his younger days suggest that Winston Smith was an unrepentantly selfish child who was willing to disregard the dire straits of his own mother and baby sister in order to get what he wanted. Could we not say that the adult Winston does the same? That he's more interested in freedom for himself than for others? Is his rebellion against Big Brother political or personal? He claims that he wants to see the world changed and freedom brought to all people, but how far can we trust a mind that's been so well trained in doublethink? Now this, of course, gets right back to that big question of why people do the right thing, when it might be so much easier and profitable to do otherwise. Atticus Finch could have let Tom Robinson swing, thus saving himself and his family a whole lot of trouble, just as Winston could have just given up and emulated his neighbor, Parsons, becoming a good party member. Neither man could do that, though, because it was not in their nature to do it. It was impossible for Winston to continue to live the way the party wanted him to live, and given time, he may have been able to reach beyond meeting his own personal needs and seeing to the needs of his greater community, but unfortunately we never get the chance to find that out, because the Thought Police eventually get tired of watching him and take him in. Now, to his credit, he does hold out to the last extreme before he betrays Julia in his heart, so perhaps he is kind of brave after all. The other thing that came to mind while I read this was the modern use of the word Orwellian and how it falls vastly short of what's depicted in this book. It gets thrown about every time a city pops up a few CCTV cameras downtown or a business decides to put up surveillance in their store. It shows up when we put RFID chips in passports and credit cards or when we think about how much Google the data has about us or Sony used to have. The word brings to mind a sense of constant surveillance, never being able to move or act without some government or corporation knowing what we're doing. Now, while the concept of the two-way telescreens in this book certainly are a logical extension of surveillance culture, to call a customer database or red light cameras Orwellian is like calling a Bronze Age chariot a Ferrari. It betrays an incredible lack of understanding of exactly what is going on in the world that Orwell's built. We may be watched by those people, but in comparison to the average citizen of Oceana, prole or party member, we are remarkably free. There are still freedoms available to us. And when I say us, you know, I'm kind of speaking from my perspective as Americans, but you know, other people in modernized first world democracies. Let's kind of define our terms here. There are still freedoms available to us that people like Winston never had and couldn't even understand if they were offered. We can protest. We can voice our disagreements. We can channel our energies into whatever pursuit we choose, or not channel them at all. We have the freedom to decide who we want to be and how we want to live, at least within the limits of a well-ordered society. We do not live in daily terror that we might be abducted from our beds, our lives ended, and our very existences erased from record and memory. Honestly, I think that a few security cameras pale in comparison to the horror that is Oceana and the world of Big Brother. Really, there is just, there's so much to talk about with this book. For example, I find Newspeak fascinating, especially as a language teacher, and Newspeak's foundations are amazing and terrifying at the same time. The idea that a concept can only truly exist if there's a word for it brings to mind those kind of untranslatable words you find in every single language. For example, there is no equivalent to the English verb miss in Japanese, as in, I miss my mother. Now, does that mean that people in Japan are incapable of missing their mothers? Of course not. But the underlying theory of Newspeak would suggest otherwise. Once the party reduces the English language to a series of simple words with absolutely no nuance and no subtlety of meaning, then the idea goes. Thought crime will be literally impossible. After all, how can one wish for freedom if the concept itself is impossible to articulate? Then there's the idea of the mutability of the past, the way the party exerts its unbreakable control over the population by virtue of the fact that they control all the media, the newspapers, the radio, the television, publishing of all sorts. If the party wants to, claim that Big Brother invented the airplane, all they have to do is revise all relevant media to reflect that desired past, and then replace and destroy anything that disagrees with them. It won't be easy, but with no evidence that Big Brother didn't invent the airplane, all that's left is just fallible human memory. And those who think they remember the right version of the past will eventually die anyway. Whoever controls the present, the party says, controls the future. And whoever controls the past controls the present. By remaking the past, the party guarantees that they can never be gainsaid or proven to have erred in any way. Now, fortunately for us, Big Brother never had the internet to contend with. As anyone who's been online for a while knows, nothing on the internet ever goes away. Ever. The words of any leader or influential person are all there in multiple copies, all of which can themselves be copied and distributed in mere seconds. While it is possible to fake a photograph, the awareness of that possibility, as well as the technology to suss out the fakes, are just as available to anybody who wants them. Even in cases where there are disputes about the past or reinterpretations of past events, it's impossible for one version to systematically replace all the others. While this sometimes results in competing versions of the past, the one with the most evidence tends to prevail. And continuing in that vein, the understanding that the party controls all information about itself leads to a very interesting question that's not addressed in the book. And it's this. Is anything that is not directly observed by Winston Smith true? We're led to believe, for example, that there are three world powers, Oceania, East Asia, and Eurasia, which are locked in a state of perpetual war. The nature of this war and how it serves the interests of these nations is laid out in Goldstein's book, which is the text of the revolution that Winston and Julia want to join. But here's the thing. Goldstein's book is an admitted fiction. It was written by the party as a kind of a honeypot to bring suspects through the last stages of their thought crime. So we have no proof that the world of 1984 is actually laid out the way it appears. The party could, in fact, dominate the world, using the pretext of war to keep the world's citizens terrified, needy, and compliant. On the other extreme, Oceania could just be Britain, turned in on itself like some super-accelerated North Korea, its borders sealed and its citizens kept in utter ignorance of the world outside. We don't know. We have no way of knowing, and neither do any of the characters in the book. Even the inner party members might not know the truth of their world, and they wouldn't care if they did. I just find that really fascinating and weird. All right, one more thing, and I'll try to keep this short. Doublethink, which I mentioned before. The ability to hold two contradictory ideas in your mind, believing in both of them simultaneously, and yet being unaware that there's any conflict at all. This is different from cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is disbelieving something that is true because you believe so strongly in something else. Like on May 22nd, when we ask those people, what happened with the rapture, they will not admit they were wrong. They can't be wrong. They will come up with an explanation that makes sense to them, but to nobody else. In the context of the book, though, if you know that last week's chocolate ration was 30 grams, and at the same time you know that this week the chocolate rations had been raised to 20 grams, you know both of these things, at the same time, even though they completely contradict each other. If you want a modern example of this, look at the healthcare debate in the United States. Go back and look at some of the tapes. Here's a really fun game. See how often someone says, "We have the best healthcare in the world in this country." And then see how long it takes before that same person tells us that healthcare in the United States is irrevocably broken and needs to be fixed. Your average politician and pundit does this kind of thing all the time. And in accordance with the basic principles of doublethink, they immediately forget that they've done it. Actually, this game is really much, much easier if you watch Glenn Beck for about half an hour. Oh, Glenn, you'll be missed. I mean, there's so much to get from this book. Maybe the most important thing to get from this book is this. The world depicted in 1984 is not an impossible one, but it is improbable. The people of that world allowed the party to take over for them in a time of crisis, and in that sense, the book is a warning to us all. It's a warning to keep the power that we have and to resist the temptation to let a government or a corporation or anyone else decide who we should be. So that is 1984. Let me give you my favorite quote from this because it kind of encapsulates the modern human condition. Winston Smith, writing in his diary, he writes, "I understand how. I do not understand why." For me, that line, those two sentences, pretty much describe modern life to me. I don't know why, but anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. That was good fun. Like I said, 1984, it's one of those books that I could just read and then reread and then read again on a regular basis. Not too often. I'll get really depressed, but it can be done. So, we are going somewhat over time, or at least longer than we have in the last couple of weeks, so let me give you a clue. Next week, much to my surprise, is the last Thursday of the month. Whoa. So that means it is time for an interim series. I'm going to give you a 3-book series. The next 3 months we'll be covering this. For those of you who are a little tired of what vampires have become, and I am, yes, referencing Twilight, which no, I have not read yet, and I know that I should, but I'm not, because it's scary. Not scary, but you know what I mean. There are good modern vampire books out there. This series involves good modern vampires, and was one of the more surprising films to come out of Russia in the last 10 years or so. So what do you think? What's the book? What's the series? If you guess correctly, you win a Frozen Wasteland. Congratulations. So that is about it. I hope that you enjoy the rest of your week. I hope you're having good weather and enjoying yourself. And I will talk to you all next week. A text version of this review will be up on the blog, thelablib.org, along with any relevant links I can think of. If you have anything you want to say or any suggestions you'd like to make, please leave a comment and let me know. If you have a book you would like to recommend, I would be happy to hear it. If you'd like to send me an email, send it to labyrinthlibrary@gmail.com. And if you like what you hear, please give a review on iTunes, become a fan on Facebook, or follow LabLib on Twitter. This podcast is covered by a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, so feel free to share it, but please don't sell it or change it. The music is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod at www.incompetech.com. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week. And until then, keep reading.